There's so many things going on in the world. Baby's dying, mother's crying. How much all is one human life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? We believe everything that they tell us. They're gonna kill us, so we gotta kill them first. But I remember a commandment, thou shalt not kill. And how much is a soldier's life worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
And you're listening to Peace Radio. We'll be right back after Willie Nelson.
We've been told from our birth, hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? So I guess it's just due unto others before they can do it to you. Let's just kill them all and let God sort them out. Is this what God wants us to do? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? Now you probably won't hear this on your radio, probably not on your local TV. But if there's a time and you're ever inclined, you can always hear it from me. But how much is a picker's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth? But don't confuse caring for weakness. You can't put that label on me. The truth is my weapon of mass protection, and I believe that truth sets you free. And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
All righty, that was Willie Nelson. Welcome, as Jerry said, welcome to Peace Radio. We've mixed it up this week. You'll be listening to Jerry Swenson and Sally Perrine, who we will be here for the next couple of hours, bringing you some music, some commentary, some pre-recorded stuff. And second hour, we'll be blessed with the visit of Rula Awad Rafferty, who's going to bring us information from Palestine, Israel, and also... Rula was in Chicago early this month, involved in a panel discussion entitled "Palestinians and Israelis on 1948 and the Right of Return." So we'll be hearing from her about her travels and her wonderful info that she always has for us. First hour, we'll be also hearing from Susan Gallimore via what's the radio.
Raising Sand.
Raising Sand Radio, yeah. And then Jerry will bring us some Middle East report at the end of the first hour. But first, I guess, weather and then our usual bummer news, which we always bring.
Well, tonight it's going to be partly cloudy with a low of around 41, so it looks like we might get some freezing, maybe slick roads in the morning. Monday, mostly sunny with a high of 43, and Monday night it's going to be cloudy again, a low of 33. So clouds will keep a little bit of that heat in, probably won't be quite as frozen in the morning. And Tuesday morning it's going to be mostly sunny with a high of 41 and partly cloudy in the evening with a low of 28, so getting colder Tuesday night. Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high of only 39. So it's going to get colder toward the middle of the week, and looks like no precipitation involved. So well, it looks like pretty normal early winter weather.
About what we expect this time of year, right?
That's right.
Okay. I'm going to start with some, actually, some activist news. This weekend in Seattle, and we're missing it, unfortunately, but hopefully there's some people from the area over there, is the People's Summit. And more than 85 organizations are coming together this weekend for People's Summit to show another world is possible, a world of economic fairness, environmental health, and justice for all. The weekend-long People's Summit running this weekend, November 27th through 29, at multiple venues, features internationally renowned speakers, strategic workshops, performances, and solution-oriented networking. The event marks the 10th anniversary of the Seattle protests.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Right, when tens of thousands of people made history by shutting down the World Trade Organization's ministerial meetings. Workers, environmental activists, and faith communities came together in November 1999 for several days of unprecedented, nonviolent street protests. Were you there, Jerry?
No, I wasn't.
Me neither. I wish I'd been. Yeah. I know lots of local people mm-hmm. were able to be there. 10 years later, with international economies in collapse and global temperatures rising, groups are coming together again to critique powerful institutions who they say still lack workable solutions to contemporary international crises. The Seattle event falls within a week of national and international events. Protests are being planned in Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles, and New York, and across the world in Geneva, where the WTO is meeting again on November 30th, and in Copenhagen at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, December 7th through 18th. So if you're interested, there is a website, seattleplus10.org. Might be fun to see and to follow what's going on in Seattle. Do have some news from Afghanistan. The usual, as we said earlier, bummer news from the two war sites. Two Afghan teenagers held in U.S. detention north of Kabul this year said they were beaten by American guards, photographed naked, deprived of sleep, and held in solitary confinement in concrete cells, the Washington Post reported late Friday. The newspaper said the teenagers had been held in these cells for at least 2 weeks while undergoing daily interrogation about their alleged links to the Taliban. The accounts could not be independently substantiated, but in successive on-the-record interviews, the teenagers presented a detailed, consistent portrait suggesting that the abusive treatment of suspected insurgents has in some cases continued under the administration of President Barack Obama. The two teenagers, Isa Mohammed, 17, and Abdul Rashid, who said he was younger than 16, said that they were punched and slapped in the face by their captors during their time at Bagram Air Base, where they were held in individual cells. Rashid said his interrogator forced him to look at pornography alongside a photograph of his mother. The holding center described by the teenagers appeared to have been a facility run by U.S. Special Operations Forces that is separate from the Bagram Theater internment facility, the main American-run prison. The teenagers' descriptions of a holding area on a different part of the Bagram base are consistent with the accounts of two other former detainees who say they endured similar mistreatment but not beatings while being held last year at what Afghans call Bagram's Black Prison. And more news from Afghanistan. The U.S. military has announced the opening of a new prison on Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. This prison, costing $60 million, will hold up to 1,100 prisoners at any one time. How come we have money for that?
Yeah, really.
U.S. Brigadier General Mark Martins, a U.S. Army lawyer who undertook an examination this year of Afghan and American prisons, said that the prison would be handed over to the Afghan government, though it is unclear when that handover will take place. Last week, reporters were taken on a tour of the facility, a dramatic move by the military as no journalists and few visitors were allowed inside the old prison. The tour was part of a U.S. effort to show more transparency. Washington has been accused of a variety of human rights violations against Afghan detainees at Bagram. Brigadier General Martin stressed that vocational training will be available at the facility to give job skills to those who have been held there. A review board which examines prisoners' cases will sit at the new jail as well as provide resources for prisoners to challenge their detention through legal means. By the end of this year, about 700 prisoners from the old prison will be transferred to the new facility. Some legal analysts say that a foreign power building a prison on Afghan soil to hold Afghans without charge is, in fact, illegal. Nasrullah Stanikzai, professor of law at Kabul University, says that according to Afghan and international law, the right to hold citizens against their will belongs solely to a nation's government. He described the act of building such a prison on Afghan soil without being subject to Afghan laws as a revocation of Afghanistan's independence.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. Despite these protests, the new facility should be an improvement over the old. What is known about the old prison is that prisoners have been treated severely at the old facility. In 2002, two prisoners died there after severe beatings, which included chaining the men to the ceiling and beating their legs. A military coroner's report likened the condition of the bodies to those that had been run over by a bus. So, enough bummer news at the moment.
Okay, and the time is 11 minutes after 2, and it's about time for Veterans News. And for Veterans News today, we have an interview that Susan Galley Moore did for Raising Sand Radio with J.C. Smith, who's going to talk about Operation Stand Down.
J.C. Smith speaks to us by phone from Operation Stand Down in Nashville, Tennessee. J.C. Smith plays, among other roles, the Veterans Outreach Coordinator, and he begins by introducing Operation Stand Down.
Well, Operation Stand Down is a nonprofit veteran service agency, and being a nonprofit, you have to wear a lot of hats. I'm also the Veterans Alumni Coordinator and HPRP Grant Coordinator, which is a homeless rehousing homelessness prevention grant that we just got from HUD.
And how did you come up with the name Operation Stand Down?
Well, Operation Stand Down is it's part of veterans or military history. Stand down is when a group of soldiers are ordered to step back from the conflict, move back to a safe place, so to speak.
And in this case, the safe place is you deal with homelessness and veterans.
Yes, that was our initial mission, was to basically help the community reestablish ties with its veterans, homeless veterans being our main goal. And homeless and veterans shouldn't even be in the same sentence, but, you know, it has come to the forefront lately with the homelessness problem in the United States. From that, we've branched off into an employment service, a transitional housing program, and now with the family support unit that the HUD grant stimulus has given us an opportunity to help out some other people as well.
We're going to talk a little more detail about how and who you serve, but I wanted to mention that at the Veterans Affairs National Summit on Ending Homelessness Among Vets, Eric Shinseki most recently said that there were about 131,000 veterans living on the streets at on any given night, and it actually goes up, the number goes up. That's a lot. As you said, homeless and veterans shouldn't really be in the same sentence.
Yes, that's probably a conservative estimate, and the reason being is the homelessness epidemic in the United States is very hard to track, mainly because of the environment that homeless people tend to dwell in. So the numbers are hard to keep up with. Veterans make up about 30% of the homeless population, and about 5% of those homeless veterans are females. They tend to be able to survive in much harsher conditions, so you may not see a lot of veterans walking around on the streets, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that, as you mentioned here, they're very hard to track, what do you think of Shinseki's statement that President Obama and I are personally committed to ending homelessness among veterans within the next 5 years?
I think that's an awesome and a beautiful sentiment. I don't believe it's realistic. As much belief that I have in our United States government and the missions that it has successfully accomplished, I think that one's just a little bit out of reach. We started out with a 10-year mission to end homelessness 7 years ago, and it has been reported that the numbers are down. I just find that kind of hard to believe sometimes.
And apparently the veterans of the Iraq-Afghanistan war are actually going into homelessness a lot faster than we've seen, say, the vets from Vietnam or other war-era vets.
That is exactly true. What used to take about 10 years, now the turnaround time is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 months.
And what do you think that's about?
The recognition of a lot of the co-occurring disorders or issues that happen among homeless veterans in the first place. Most veterans who become homeless, usually it is has something to do with their mental health state. A lot of them have post-traumatic stress. A lot of them also use the mind-altering substances to self-medicate, which leads to addictive behavior and conditions. That's more readily recognized today than it was back in the late mid-70s and before, when the Vietnam era vet came home. They usually they were pretty much known to drink hard and party hard, and most people just kind of wrote them off as, you know, that's just a part of war itself.
Mm-hmm. And in your mission, helping the community establish ties with veterans, how does that work to break that that image?
Well, it's not so difficult today. Well, I'm a Vietnam veteran myself, and when I came home, I did not make it well known that I was a veteran. Veterans are viewed in a different light today. I think there is an honor and a virtue of being a U.S. military veteran today. In order to reestablish ties with the community, anyone would have to contribute to that community. And as a contributor, we have to have some assets or something to give back. And what we try to do here at Operation Stand Down is instill in our veterans some work ethic. We try to get them employed. We try to get them on a track of community service. To become more fulfilling in their lifestyle, you know, being a part of a community, they already have established that with their military family. We just try to extend that into the civilian or community family.
Because it's true that veterans, well, not veterans yet, but the people, the young people in the military actually learn quite well to be part of a group and part of a community and function within that very well. It's the transition back to civilian that's so difficult, isn't it?
That's correct. And civilian life is just so much less rigid than military life. And I believe that's part of the transitionary problem, is that in the military, you everything is outlined. And you don't really have a choice as to who you're friend or a foxhole companion is going to be, so you learn to adapt and overcome. In civilian life, it's just an open arena. You can make choices, and a lot of times those are wrong choices. Nobody's making them for you. It's totally up to you. The responsibility and accountability is totally up to you, whereas that's not the case in the military.
We're talking with J.C. Smith of Operation Stand Down in Tennessee. J.C., do you think that the difference between, as you say, you were in Vietnam, but you were more than likely drafted, do you think it makes a difference that the Iraq and Afghanistan vets are volunteers?
Yes, I do. I think that they are a little bit more a part of the mission than we were in the Vietnam era. Now, I myself was not drafted. I joined the Army myself, but the majority, of course, were drafted. I think that if a person has a mission, to begin with, has a goal, that does instill some personal attachment to their what they're doing, and I think mm-hmm. it is very helpful. I think that the soldiers today take a lot more pride and honor in what they do.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it even doubly difficult if they end up on the street within such a short period of getting back to their lives here in the United States.
Yes, I agree. And I think that the transition is much more difficult because, you know, if you have pretty much become a part of that military ideology and their perspective of things, and all of a sudden you are now back in a civilian environment, it is a big adjustment to make. And whereas when a lot of the Vietnam veterans just wanted to get back home, that was their only mission in life. I just need to survive long enough to get back home.
Mm-hmm.
They did more of the self-medicating and those things to deal with the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And is Operation Stand Down in other, is it a network around the country, or is it predominantly headquartered in Nashville?
Well, our Operation Stand Down here is a full-service agency. We're open Monday through Friday, 7:30 to 4. Operations Stand Down around the country can be anything from a one-day event to a three-day event. Some cities have them for 3 days. We have an annual Stand Down event still. We just celebrated our 17th annual Stand Down event this past October, and it was a great success. We basically served 426 homeless veterans. Served them meals, housed them for 3 days, gave them clothes, got them services that we had all in one place, which is a lot of the homeless issue is the fact that you have to go so many different places to get so many different services, and we had it all in one stop.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably three or five other full-service stand-down agencies in the country.
What else would you like our listeners to know about the organization Operation Stand Down?
One of the main things I always like to convey to other agencies and people who are interested in our community donating time and volunteerism is that 87 cents of every dollar that was donated to Stand Down actually goes toward the client that we serve. That makes us a very efficient agency, of course. But I believe that that efficiency comes from our dedication and commitment to what we do. It's kind of like a car salesman or a salesman. If you are selling something you love, you really don't have to work at it. And we are veterans helping veterans here. So we love what we do, and I think that's why our success is so great and our reputation is so solid today.
And how are you supported?
We're supported through grants and donations. We have multiple grants, everything from United Way, HUD, Department of Labor, then also charitable agencies, volunteers, in-kind donations. We are totally nonprofit.
Do you get anything from Veterans Affairs?
We do share a program with Veterans Affairs. It's what they call a per diem program. In our housing unit, transitional housing program, if a veteran comes through a substance abuse treatment program, the Veterans Affairs will assist us in their overhead, so to speak, for up to 2 years. That usually comes out to about $30 a day.
Hmm. Why don't you give our listeners information how they can contact Operation Stand Down?
I'd be happy to. If you wanted to contact Stand Down, you would call area code 615-248-1981, and we are located at 1125 12th Avenue South, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203. And our website is www.osdnashville.org.
OSDNashville.org.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for being with us, JC. I really appreciate your time. I actually have a family member who served in the military who lives in Nashville, so he's not homeless, but he should definitely know about your organization.
Well, our doors are open to everyone, but we are honored to have a veteran stop by and look around and sometimes just lend a shoulder or an ear to some of the veterans that are having some troubles today. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And that was J.C. Smith from Operation Stand Down, osdnashville.org, or 615-248-1981.
That was Susan Gallimore with an interview she did earlier this month, just prior to Veterans Day. And now, a little Michael Frente.
You tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. Help me make them all come true. Tell me that the rain won't fall today. Tell me that the tax man lost his way. Tell me that the hurting ain't gonna hurt no more.
No, it ain't gonna hurt no more.
Tell me that somebody stopped the war.
Please tell me.
Tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. When I cannot bear the truth, you tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. Help me make them all come true. I say yeah, 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 yeah. I say yeah, 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 yeah. Tell me that the whole world's wonderful.
Yes, it is.
Tell me that the bank account's too full. Tell me that we all got plenty of time, time, time.
Tell me something.
Tell me that I ain't gonna lose my mind.
Lift me up now.
Tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. When I cannot bear the truth, tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. Help me make them all come true. Ain't no, I'm just a man with my heart in my hand. You tell me things at home, and ghosts won't leave me alone. And even though I got no plans, or I'm on the run from the man, you just hold on to me. You just hold on to me. I need a prayer. Every time I need to share. Every time I need someone to hold on to. You tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. When I cannot bear the truth,
when I can't bear the truth.
You tell me lies, 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 sweet little lies. Help me make them all come true.
Help me make them all come true.
Help me make them all come true.
Help me make them.
Help me make them all come true.
Help me, help me, help me.
Help me make them all come true.
When I can't stand pain.
Help me make them all come true.
Help me, help me. Tell me that the whole world's wonderful, yeah. Yo, this is the original Dariku Squadron, KRFP Moscow, yeah. Let's go.
All righty, you're listening to Peace Radio KRFP Moscow. Sally and Jerry here with you. We have a couple of PSAs. The League of Women Voters meets Wednesdays from 12 to 1, generally at the Fisk Community Room in the 1912 Center on 412 East 3rd Street. Guests are welcome. This next Wednesday, December 2nd, the speaker will be Cami McClure, Executive Director of the Lionel Hampton International Jazz Festival. The following Wednesday, same place, same time, 12 to 1 at the Fisk Center, Fisk Room 1912 Center. Jeff Martin, President and Chief Executive Officer, will be speaking on a topic, What's New at Grittman Hospital. So these events are free, open to the public. Wonderful organization. It's been going on for a very long time. Also, join Grittman Medical Center's social work staff as they present How to Survive the Holiday Blues at a lunch and learn meeting Friday, December 11th from 12 to 1 p.m. The event is free and will be held in the Grittman Conference Center, 700 South Main, Moscow. A light snack will be served. Grittman social workers Sarah Riel and Crystal Schluter will give holiday stress-reducing tips as well as discuss the difference between depression and SAD. Lunch and Learn is sponsored by the Grittman Education Department. Call 883-2232 for more information. These are PSAs from our community. All righty, let's go on with a bit more local news, just local peace. We were initially titled this Peace History, but it's Peace, not History, Peace Current. The Palouse Peace Coalition vigils are ongoing Friday afternoons, 5:30 to 6:30 at Moscow's Friendship Square. Please join us and stand in solidarity. We've been meeting for, 9 years?
Since November 2001.
2001. Meeting every Friday, and we'll do so until, as one of our members said, peace breaks out. But we're also pleased to have contacts with the Spokane Peace Organization, PJALS, and the Idaho Peace Coalition in Boise, both of which organizations are very active and continuing the work of just kind of bringing information and activism to their respective communities. In Spokane, apparently they have a rally planned, rapid response plan, what they're calling Red Wednesday, next Wednesday, if Obama announces on Tuesday evening that he will order more troops to Afghanistan, which is looking more and more likely. The PJALS group will protest on Wednesday at 5 p.m. at the corner of Division and Wellesley. And if you want to join, the phone number is 509-838-7870 to join the Rapid Response phone team, or email pjals@pjals.net. Help spread the word. There's apparently a Facebook presence as well. Invite your friends. When we rally, they were saying, wear red, the sign to stop, and the color of blood. Bring your family and friends. War is bad for families here and in Afghanistan. And bring pots and pans for percussion. We want money for food to fill pots and pans worldwide, not for war. So that's up in Spokane, the wonderful organization that's been going on for many, many years. In Boise, Boise Idaho Peace Coalition has a nice web presence, so if you're interested, check them out. And they are currently, one of their current actions is a subgroup called Voices for Palestine, Idahoans working to end the occupation of Palestine. And they are sponsoring Palestinian refugees in Boise. The latest is a woman named Aliyah and her children. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, Aliyah, her husband, and two children had to flee Baghdad. As Palestinians, they could not return to Jerusalem, but they found safety at Al-Walid refugee camp on the border of Iraq and Syria. Shortly after, Aliyah's husband was kidnapped and murdered by Iraqi militia. 2 months ago, Aliyah and her two children, now 5 and 7 years old, were relocated to Boise. They came with essentially nothing and are only being given the very basics to survive. Voices for Palestine is taking up a collection to help her and her children. We hope to provide her with the essentials as well as some things that will allow Aliyah to eventually support herself and her kids. Please visit the website voicesforpalestine.wordpress.com. They need specifically books, toys, and art supplies for the kids. There's a phone number here in Boise, 208-230-1150, and the woman's name is Lama Nasser. That number again is 208-230-1150. And we just got a phone call from our very own Lee Robardis, the station manager here, who will be playing audio after Louis's show from 6 to 8, apparently. He'll be playing audio from the WTO event in 1999, which
right,
he attended.
That he took, and it's going to be the raw footage.
Right. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned to KRFP, right. Moscow. All righty. I'm going to read, as we do every week or every 2 weeks, the human toll, the names of the dead in the two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, courtesy of the November 30th, 2009 edition of the Army Times. The following U.S. service members died while supporting combat operations in Iraq, confirmed by the Defense Department from November 13th through November 19th, 2009. Navy Petty Officer Second Class Brian M. Patton, 37, of Freeport, Illinois. Army Sergeant Brian T. Williams, 25, of Sparks, Georgia. Army Staff Sergeant Ryan L. Zorn, 35, of Upton, Wyoming. From November 13th through November 19th, 3 killed, 5 wounded in action. And from March 19th, 2003 through November 19th, 2009, 4,351 killed, 31,571 wounded in action in Iraq. The following U.S. service members died while supporting combat operations in Afghanistan, confirmed by the Defense Department from November 13th through November 19th. Army Staff Sergeant John J. Cleaver, 36, of Marysville, Washington. Army Sergeant Daniel A. Frazier, 25, of St. Joseph, Missouri. Marine Lance Corporal Nicholas J. Hand, 20, of Kansas City, Missouri, and Army Specialist Joseph M. Lewis, 26, of Terrell, Texas. And from November 13th through November 19th, 4 killed, 57 wounded in Iraq, in Afghanistan, from October 10th, 2001, through November 19th, 2009, 914 killed, 4,529 wounded in action in Afghanistan. What a waste. We're going to play a little bit of Bruce Springsteen's Bring 'Em Home, because that's what we believe is the best option here.
Thanks, Sally. Bruce Springsteen.
If you love this land of the free, bring 'em home, bring 'em home. Bring 'em back from overseas. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. It'll make the politicians sad, I know. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They wanna tangle with their foe. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They wanna test their grand theories. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. With the blood of you and me. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. We'll give no more brave young lives. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. For the gleam in someone's eyes. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home.
That was Bruce Springsteen, Bring 'Em Home. And we're going to go on to the Middle East report. Today we have a few clips from Al Jazeera that we're going to feature.
Mm-hmm. I'm Mariam Namazi in Doha with the stories we're featuring on Al Jazeera. In Switzerland, exit polls suggest Swiss voters have supported a ban on the building of new minarets in a nationwide referendum. Right-wing parties claim the prayer towers on mosques are a political symbol of Islam rather than being purely religious. The motion still needs the support of the country's 26 regional cantons. Muslim community leaders and opposition parties say the ban breaks European law. There are about 400,000 Muslims in Switzerland. Al Jazeera's Alan Fisher is in the Swiss capital Bern. He says such a high level of public support for the ban was not what polls were predicting.
There is concern in Switzerland, undoubtedly, about what's seen as the spread of radical Islam. But the Muslim community here in Switzerland has always been regarded as fairly moderate. They were saying that they would like to see this vote defeated. They wanted to make sure that the proposal didn't go through. So I'm sure it's a real shock to them that at the moment what we're seeing is that most of the people have voted in favour.
The people of Honduras are electing a new president in the hope of drawing a line under months of political uncertainty. A coup 5 months ago saw President Manuel Zelaya driven from office. The interim government, which replaced him, is hoping the election will signal an end to the international isolation that followed Zelaya's departure. Al Jazeera's Lucia Newman says it's unclear how many people will heed Zelaya's call for a boycott.
A lot of people don't want to go to the polls. They tell us that they are disillusioned, that they don't believe that these are fair elections being conducted by a de facto illegitimate government. But others really tell us that while they may have disagreed with the overthrow of President Manuel Zelaya, they see this election as the only way for this country to move forward. They say that the isolation of this country internationally, the fact that international loans and in some cases even trade have been reduced or completely cut is hurting the ordinary people, the poor people of this country. They just want to get things back to normal, they say, and that if the elections are the way to do it, then so be it.
And the Washington Post reported yesterday China's backing on Iran followed dire predictions. 2 weeks before President Obama visited China, two senior White House officials traveled to Beijing on a special mission to try to persuade China to pressure Iran to give up its alleged nuclear weapons program. If Beijing did not help the United States on this issue, the consequences could be severe, the visitors, Dennis Ross and Jeffrey Bader, both told senior officials in the National Security Council and informed the Chinese. The Chinese were told that Israel regards Iran's nuclear program as an existential issue, and that countries that have existential issues don't listen to other countries. According to a senior administration official, the implication was clear. Israel could bomb Iran, leading to a crisis in the Persian Gulf region and almost inevitably problems over the very oil China needs to fuel its economic juggernaut, said the official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Earlier this week, the White House got its answer. China informed the United States that it would support a toughly worded U.S.-backed statement criticizing the Islamic Republic for flouting U.N. resolutions by constructing a secret uranium enrichment plant. The statement obtained by the Washington Post is part of a draft resolution to be taken up as soon as Thursday by the 35 nations that make up the governing board of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.N. nuclear watchdog. And here's Al Jazeera's take on the story.
This is one of the most dramatic announcements to come out of Tehran. Tension between Iran and a large part of the international community has been growing in the last 48 hours. Now the Iranian government has been precise in its plans. It's told its nuclear agency to begin work on five new uranium enrichment sites, with five more to be located over the next 2 months. According to reports, they will be the size of the current Natanz plant, which is extensive. This development comes 2 days after the UN nuclear watchdog rebuked Iran for covering up a uranium enrichment plant near Qom. Earlier Sunday, the Iranian parliament urged President Ahmadinejad to reduce cooperation with the watchdog.
We carefully monitor your future acts, and if you don't give up your ridiculous carrot and stick policy, we will design a new pattern regarding Iran's relationship with you.
Other parliamentarians were equally furious, making clear they are prepared to carry out their threat.
If the IAEA continues to work beyond the framework of its jurisdiction and make more irresponsible decisions, the parliament will make new decisions accordingly. For now, the MPs feel it is their duty to react to the unfair decision of the IAEA in order to make the agency understand that its acts will have consequences.
Western powers say Iran is trying to develop nuclear arms. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. President Ahmadinejad said Iran will have to install 500,000 centrifuges throughout the new facilities to produce between 250 and 300 tons of fuel annually. The next step could be a call for tougher international sanctions against Iran. And this time, Russia and China could be under pressure to join in.
Ibrahim Agha has lived in Kirkuk all his life. He tells Al Jazeera that his family has been here for hundreds of years and own wide pieces of land. These documents show he has a history in this city, the history of his Turkmen family in Kirkuk. Now he is worried that he may be squeezed out.
There's been a mass deliberate migration into Kirkuk in the past years. These migration processes have changed the city's demography.
After the US-led invasion on Iraq, Kirkuk has become a city run by Kurds. Now that they are in the majority, they would like Kirkuk to become part of their semi-autonomous region in northern Iraq. What the Kurdish politicians want became a crucial issue. As Iraqi MPs debated the election reform bill, the bill states Kirkuk will be kept as one constituency. The 2009 census will be used as requested by the Kurds. While Turkmen and Arabs' proposal to use the census of 2005 was refused. Arab and Turkmen critics of the bill believe that this is an attempt by Kurdish politicians to ensure a majority in the next year's elections. They say that many of the Kurds on 2009 census are refugees and they should vote in their own constituencies. But Kurdish politicians say they have every right to protect their people.
These are the families who were displaced from Kirkuk by the old regime, and now they should return to their original city. They have been deprived of their rights.
But Muhammad Ali tells us he and his family fled the violence in the province of Salah ad-Din to find a safe home in Kirkuk. He says he's been encouraged by Kurdish politicians to settle in Kirkuk and to vote for Kurds.
I have been paid $4,000 and promised a piece of land to build a small house. I want to be safe about my family. I will vote for Kurdish Alliance if my conditions become better.
That was the Middle East report. And now a selection from the Austin Lounge Lizards, the Ballad of Ronald Reagan.
They say he was the all-American boy. Then he went out to Hollywood to make himself a name, and he went on to minor motion picture fame. They called him Ronald Reagan. He starred in movies with the chimpanzee and in a Western series on TV. He spoke for Goldwater with rhetorical zip, and he coasted to the California governorship. They called him Ronald Reagan. Taxes got entirely out of hand, but he was held over by popular demand. If it took a bloodbath to stop student unrest, then that's what the ungrateful little bastards would get, 'cause he was Ronald Reagan. Big Ronald Reagan. The Democrats had them a candidate destined to go down in flames. He said that Ronald would drop the bomb while imitating John Wayne.
Bigger than yours,
he wanted to be LBJ
or Harry Truman at least.
But with his partner Mondale, Jimmy Carter suffered defeat. The military budget grew obese, and justice was entrusted to Ed Meese. He supported South Africa, sold missiles to Iran, a strategic initiative to kill his fellow man. He was Ronald Reagan. The
lobbyists are counting their loot from the man with the dyed hair and the Teflon suit. He's our good old president, and I am so pleased, 'cause he knows that pollution comes mainly from trees. Yes, he's Ron, Ronald Reagan. He's our good old president, he's star of the show. He'll balance the budget in a billion years or so. Yes, he's Ron, Ronald Reagan. He's our good old president, I think it's really swell. But if he wants me in Nicaragua, then he can go to hell. Yes, he's Ron, Ronald Reagan. He's our gun-running president, he's slippery as a squid. He's stupid if he didn't know, dishonest if he did. Yes, he's Ron, Ronald Reagan. He's our good old president, his policies I curse, but at least he's not Nixon. He's even worse. Yes, he's Ron, Ronald Reagan. Big Ron!
Ballad of Ronald Reagan. I'm going to read a little bit about the Fort Benning, Georgia protests, which occurred a couple of weeks ago. Actually, 1 week ago, last weekend. And that also involved, I'm not sure this year, but it has involved in the past local folks who have gone down to Fort Benning, Georgia. Thousands of people gathered at the gates of Fort Benning to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the killings of 14-year-old Celia Ramos, her brother, her mother, Elba Ramos, and the six Jesuit priests with whom she worked at the Central American University in San Salvador. Nearly 5,000 people are gathered in the pouring rain, according to Larry White, a protester who spoke to Truth Out journalists. Earlier in the day, following a rally featuring a performance by the Indigo Girls, activists participated in the yearly Presente March, ending at Fort Benning. During the march, activists carried crosses with the names of the victims of brutal repression in Central America. According to White, 50 of the marchers left the permitted route and are being threatened with arrests. Four people were arrested earlier in the day for crossing onto the base. They were Nancy Gwynn of Syracuse, New York, Michael Wally of Washington, D.C., Kenneth Hayes of Austin, Texas, and Franciscan priest Father Louis Vitale of Oakland, California. The four are currently in military custody. The four people stepped onto the post sometime the morning of Sunday, November 22nd, last week. In an update later in the week, three of the four arrested for entering the base have been released and will face trial in January of 2010. Michael Wally is continuing his protest by refusing to post bail and will remain locked up until their trial in January 2010. And Truth Out will follow the events and keep all of us updated. According to a press release from the American Friends Service Committee, Father Roy Bourgeois and School of the Americas Watch have been nominated for one of the most prestigious awards in the world, the Nobel Peace Prize, for their sustained, faithful, nonviolent witness against the disappearances, torture, and murder of hundreds of thousands of civilians, peasants, community and union organizers, clerics, missionaries, educators, and health workers by foreign military personnel trained by the U.S. military at U.S. taxpayer expense at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. And I think really, Jerry, most Americans still don't know that this is going on and has been going on.
Yeah,
it's
forever.
Not widespread knowledge yet.
Seems odd.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It just doesn't. The candidacy of Father Roy and SOA Watch for the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize has been officially submitted to the Nobel Committee in Oslo, Norway, by the American Friends Service Committee. I love that organization, too. A Nobel Peace Prize winner themselves. The official announcement was made by AFSC Representative John Meyer on Sunday, November 22nd at 9 a.m. at the gates of Fort Benning, home of the School of the Americas, during the annual November vigil to close the SOA. "We are deeply honored and deeply humbled to be nominated for this prize for peace," commented Bourgeois, a Vietnam veteran, Purple Heart recipient, and a Catholic priest who helped found SOA Watch. "This nomination is a recognition of the work of the thousands struggling against militarism across the Americas." SOA Watch is a nonviolent grassroots movement that works through creative protest and resistance. Legislative and grassroots media work to stand in solidarity with the people of Latin America to close the School of the Americas, renamed, and I never can remember this, of course,
WISC,
the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, which sounds rather
which
benign.
Which spells out WISC.
Really. So anyway.
As in sweep it under the rug.
Yeah. So anyway, SOA Watch is a good website follow this ongoing thing. And, of course, some of our local folks have gone down there, including Rich Weckerly, who ended up spending 6 months in jail because of his stand for peace.
And that was the same year that Kathy Kelly crossed the line, too.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, it's about 3 minutes to 3 o'clock, and you're listening to Peace Radio on KRFP, Moscow, Idaho. What do we have now? Oh, we have a counterpoise to some of the bummer news that Sally's been bringing us. We've got news from our parallel universe as channeled by The Onion.
Pakistani officials are expressing outrage following what many in the international community are calling the brutal and unjustified use of Hillary Clinton against their nation. Secretary of State Clinton hit Islamabad at approximately 9 a.m. yesterday as most civilians were starting their workday or attending morning prayers. Just hours after Clinton arrived, the UN released a statement condemning the United States, saying, quote, under no circumstances is there ever a justification for the preemptive deployment of Hillary Clinton anywhere by any country. Joining us now is Pakistan's ambassador to the United States, Hassam Amdiri. Thank you for being here, Mr. Ambassador. Preliminary figures we have here showing over 500 civilians suffered the full force of Mrs. Clinton, and over 1,000 more may have suffered some exposure to her inflexible hair and pseudo-folksy hand gestures.
It's horrible. Innocent women and even children had to endure her stiffly rehearsed stories about farmers she met who inspired her. She was even sent into a hospital.
That's awful.
Mr. Obama clearly regards our people as beneath human dignity to have unleashed such a woman upon us.
The Red Cross has set up camps just across the Afghan border for the tens of thousands of refugees who fled their homes to avoid Mrs. Clinton.
They
Is
were
that
the
right?
lucky ones. Many more were trapped inside the Clintonized area and could not escape her clumsy attempts to relate
so
to them.
So people were caught completely unaware.
I'm afraid so. The Hillary Clinton warning sirens sounded just a few minutes before she hit. It was too late for most people. They had to endure her cacophonous fake laughter.
Sir, I'm just getting word that the White House has released the following statement. We reserve the right to use Hillary Clinton in situations where all other options have failed. Mr. Ambassador, this sounds like a threatening tone.
It is horrible. The world must unite against this act of naked aggression. Let 1,000 Hillary Clintons rain down upon those responsible for this.
All right, Mr. Amdiri, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Intelligence reports have indicated that Pakistan is developing its own Hillary Clinton and that Anita Alvey, a stiff, humorless provincial representative, could be ready to use against a major U.S. city as soon as 2011.
I'm Michael Coe, filling in for Clifford Baines, who knows too much and can't trust anyone. Well, Joe Biden's big mouth is getting him in trouble again. Yesterday, the gaffe-prone vice president made headlines by sneezing during a policy summit at the White House. Is this type of out-of-control behavior hurting the administration?
Yeah, old Biden's known for going off script, but this is an all-time low.
Exactly.
You're at a major event. Cameras are rolling, and you sneeze.
What was he thinking?
And it was so off-message.
You cannot sneeze like that. The world is watching.
I really don't see how Biden could think a sneeze like that was appropriate.
Well, he doesn't think. That's it.
That's
he doesn't
right. He doesn't.
The editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, which was devoted entirely today to the sneezing incident, has said that Biden is unfit to hold office.
Also.
But I do think the sneeze is not going to have any major repercussions because people expect it. Biden is just a court gesture. Yeah. He's just to be laughed at.
He's representing the United States
right.
of America.
That's right.
I don't even know why he was there, frankly.
No, well, supposedly to discuss a new anti-poverty initiative that he created.
Oh, please.
Duncan, you've been blogging extensively about the sneeze since it first happened, and you say the task of defending Biden is going to fall on Obama.
Exactly. You really have to hand it to Obama because he handled this very well. He simply said, God bless you, and he moved on like it didn't even matter. But you know in private that he was furious.
He could get a big mouth Billy Bass to do a better job.
I mean, it's a stupid, stupid error from a half-human spit-spewing gaff machine, but it's an error nonetheless.
No. The leaders of China and Russia are seeing the footage, and they are thinking that we are weak we are foolish.
Yeah. Well, this is all coming just 2 weeks after the incident of Biden stopping to tie his shoes during the International Conference on Renewable Energy.
Please.
You know what? People are fed up. They are thinking, why is he doing that? Why does he think that that's okay?
Go do your job, stupid. Exactly. This isn't day camp.
And then there's the now infamous clip of Biden at the high-speed rail press conference.
Oh.
Look at that. Blink, blink, blink. He's completely off
message. I can't even watch it. It's infuriating.
They earthed a Biden life
test. It's our fault for voting Obama into office alongside a half-retarded adult baby.
Come
and
on.
Then expecting the baby not to whine and sneeze and puke and shit.
Yes, and tie his goddamn shoes in the middle of the hallway.
The public doesn't want him as vice president anymore.
Yes.
They want him beaten and whipped.
He can sneeze on his own time, not when he's representing the United States of America.
That's right.
Hang on.
Hurry, before we come to our senses.
Tragedy in the heartland today as a 17-year-old honors student burned alive after being hit by an out-of-control speeding car. A grisly death only TV host Glenn Beck could deserve. According to police, a car driving over 70 miles per hour in a 25-mile-per-hour zone struck young Rebecca Bunton as she was bicycling down a quiet street in Olathe, Kansas, shattering her rib cage and not Glenn Beck's, tragically pinning her legs, not his, to a retaining wall. Calvin Dale lives just a few blocks from the scene of the accident.
I heard screaming, and I thought it was just someone doing an accurate impression of Glenn Beck talking normally, but then I saw the smoke.
EMT Craig Anton was first on the scene.
I jumped out of the ambulance, and I ran to the wreckage to make sure that the victim was still breathing, or else was Glenn Beck.
At this impromptu vigil, friends said Rebecca was a lively girl with a bright future, a good friend who hated Glenn Beck and loved to dance.
She was just a normal kid. She wasn't some fat dumb who should have drank herself to death when she had the chance. She was so beautiful, she didn't even have little pig eyes.
Among those expressing their grief and confusion was the victim's mother.
There is no harder thing than to have Glenn Beck outlive your child. I wouldn't give anything for this to have happened to Glenn Beck.
The terrible tragedy hits especially hard following the Rottweiler mauling of someone besides Glenn Beck in Milwaukee yesterday, and the revelation that Glenn Beck was not the man trampled to death at a street carnival in Rio de Janeiro Sundays.
And that was the Onion News. And now, some Jimmy Cliff, Wonderful World, Beautiful People.
is the original Daddy Cool Squadron, KRFP Moscow. Yeah, let's go.
You're listening to Peace Radio, KRFP Moscow. Thanks, Jerry, for the Onion news. And my apologies for following it up with our usual bummer news stuff, but we have to keep some of this stuff coming in. The United States and Russia are unlikely to finish a pact to cut Cold War arsenals of nuclear weapons by a December 5th deadline, but still aim to close the deal by year-end, Russian and U.S. sources said Friday. Diplomats from the two biggest nuclear powers have been trying to prepare a new agreement on cutting atomic weapons before the 1991 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty expires. The new accord will be signed in, quote, a European country in December. A U.S. official said the December 5th deadline was ambitious, and outstanding disagreements between the two sides made it less likely that a deal would be reached in time. He added that if the deadline passed, a temporary pact could be used as a bridge. After the cuts, which have to be made within 7 years of a new treaty taking effect, the United States and Russia will still have enough firepower to destroy the world several times over.
Oh, goody.
One day after the State Department announced that the administration of U.S. President Barack Obama will not sign the 10-year-old treaty banning anti-personnel landmines, it insisted that Washington's policy on the issue was still being reviewed. Human rights and disarmament activists had reacted with outrage Wednesday to Tuesday's announcement by State Department spokesman Ian Kelly that the review had concluded and that Washington would not be able to meet our national defense needs nor our security commitments to our friends and allies if we sign the Landmine Convention. The U.S. campaign to ban landmines, a coalition of scores of activist groups, had called the Tuesday's announcement shocking, while Human Rights Watch described it as reprehensible. A leading Democratic lawmaker who spearheaded the drive in the early 90s to ban Washington's export of the weapon to other countries also decried Tuesday's announcement. Senator Patrick Leahy said the decision constituted a default of U.S. leadership in charge that appeared to be based on a review that can only be described as cursory and half-hearted. The U.S. is currently one of only 39 countries that have not signed the treaty, which was opened for signing in 1997 and took part in 1999 after a campaign led by Canada and Western Europe. Ironically, the U.S. has been in substantial compliance with most of the treaty's provisions. It has not deployed anti-personnel mines since 91, banned their export in 92, and stopped manufacturing them in 97. Washington has also spent some $1.5 billion in demining and related activities since 1993. So we just need to sign that treaty. And on Thanksgiving news, when we all around here, many of us ate too much yesterday or 2 days ago, U.S. residents are wasting food like never before. While many Americans feasted on turkey and all the fixings on Thursday, a new study finds food waste per person has shot up 50% since 1994. Some 1,400 calories worth of food is discarded per person each day, which adds up to 150 trillion calories a year, which I can't even get my head around. The study finds that about 40% of all the food produced in the United States is tossed out. Meanwhile, while some have plenty of food to spare, a recent report by the Department of Agriculture finds the number of U.S. homes lacking food security, meaning their eating habits were disrupted for lack of money. That number rose from 4.7 million in 2007 to 6.7 million last year, and about 1 billion people worldwide don't have enough to eat, according to the World Food Program. The new estimate of food waste published in the journal PLOS-1 is a relatively straightforward calculation. It's the difference between the U.S. food supply and what is actually eaten, which was estimated by using the model of human metabolism and known body weights. Last year, an international group estimated that up to 30% of food, worth about $48 billion, is wasted each year in the United States. That report concluded that despite food shortages in many countries, plenty of food is available to feed the world. It just doesn't get where it needs to go. Meanwhile, Hall and colleagues say a related and growing problem, obesity, may be fueled by the increased availability of food in this country and the incessant marketing of it. All that extra food is bad for the environment, too.